All right. So you probably couldn't tell because it sounded like Adam was playing the whole song, which is good, or played it twice. I don't know. But somewhere in the middle there, given the numbers, the line went down between where I am in Kansas at Kansas State University and Los Angeles. And so I pardon for the interruption and the moment of panic back in the studio. I never know. It happens like twice a year. And I don't know what it is. It's some internet thing. I don't know. It's not on my end that I know of, but who knows? Maybe somebody hit a light pole somewhere and it takes a second to reroute it or something. Anyway, we were talking with our guest David Rudolph, American Injustice, and haven't gotten the break in, so we'll do that real quick and take a breath, lining up the calls and the questions for you and David next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, since I asked David to come on early and stick around a little late, I promise I'll get to the calls early too. But I have to say, if David, if you're not feeling like you can make it to the end and you just got to say, I'm just running out of gas, man, I could take that last hour. But there's already a lot of people that want to talk to you. So I don't know if that's good news or bad news for you. David, are you still there? I didn't
Yeah, can
hear
you hear
him.
me?
Oh, I can now. Go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No problem. So if you're ready, then let's go with Tom in Baltimore. Maybe because of something I said, but on a wild card line on Coast to Coast AM. Tom?
Good morning, gentlemen. What a terrific show. I tuned in a little bit late, and I've been glued to the radio ever since. In answer to your question, Mr. Punnett, maybe when the studio goes out is when you're talking about truthful subject matters that certain people don't want others to know about.
Like this is kind of funny. So, David, what he's talking about is I had a minor thing where the studio went down for a second here, and it does feel a little bit like that, like somebody somewhere just like kicked a cord out of a wall or something and says, we don't need any more of that. But then I kind of think, honestly, Tom, we talk about controversial subjects all the time. So theoretically, somebody somewhere would be cutting me off like every night I get to host the show. So,
I know. I was saying that a
yeah.
bit tongue in cheek.
No, I
Yeah.
appreciate it. I actually had that very serious thought for a moment, and then I have to bring myself back to reality. But it says here you're a retired BPD cop. Is that right?
Retired police detective in Baltimore. Yes, sir.
Okay. Have you seen the HBO doc, The Slow Hustle, about the Souter case?
Yes, I certainly have. I was glued to that as well. Quite interesting.
Because it speaks to the kind of systemic problem that we're talking about, a kind of culture problem. And I would, I don't want to exaggerate, so I'll ask you about the tradition in Baltimore police history to indulge, for certain officers to indulge themselves, either by shaking down, people for money or drugs or falsely getting people to be arrested by planting evidence, that kind of thing. Do you want to comment on that so that I feel like at least I was fair?
Sure. My career began in the 80s and ended in the early 2000s. So I can only speak for that time period and then maybe give you some hearsay on what I heard through the grapevine.
Sure.
Currently, certainly by what you hear in the news locally here, it seems that issues with integrity issues, among the police officers have gotten worse. You're probably familiar with the Gun Trace Task Force, which got a
Yeah.
lot of headlines locally.
And mentioned a lot in that documentary, The Slow Hustle, the GTTF.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you're familiar with that. That's part of what I base my opinion on, that things have gotten worse. Back when I first came on, there was a real moment where police departments were wanting re to reform, from the old ways of policing to a better way of policing and dealing with the public. So that was something that I think we did a pretty good job with, even in Baltimore, for a period of time. I don't know what's happened lately, even police shootings. I am completely perplexed at the number of times the trigger is pulled. We were always taught in the Baltimore Police Academy that you're legally responsible and accountable for every pull of the trigger. So you may be justified in shooting someone, but you better make sure that the threat is stopped before you pull the trigger again, because if you stop the threat with one shot, there's no reason to continue pulling a trigger. And right. I hate to Monday morning back other police officers, but I've seen films of a lot of these police shootings. One of course was in the film that we were talking about that I just cannot wrap my brain around. It was interesting in that film, speaking about what we were taught in the Baltimore Police Academy, being accountable for every pull of the trigger, having to reassess the situation before you pull it again, because when a soldier's there to kill people, in fact, our number right. one priority is to save lives. Right. At any rate, in the film, if you recall, the former police officer who was being charged ultimately was charged with every pull of the trigger, 16 counts of aggravated assault with a and battery with a firearm. Now, the judge did not consider that in the sentencing.
Hang on, Tom, I appreciate it. David, your witness.
Yeah, you know, I'm interested in this, and I appreciate your getting on and talking about this. But it seems to me that maybe part of the problem is that police forces these days have an inordinate number of former military people who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, where when they patrolled a city, it was literally life and death. You know, they weren't there to enforce the law necessarily. They were there to patrol and to root out the terrorists. Right. And I just wonder how much of that sort of mentality has now sort of carried over into police forces that have a lot of these folks serving. I certainly don't think they ought to be disqualified, but, you know, they're coming from a situation where worrying about how many times they pull a trigger is not their primary concern. So I wonder if you can comment on that at all.
Tom?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because people have asked me, what do you think is going on? I'm only left to surmise based upon my experience and the knowledge that I have of a particular case. But getting back to what you're talking about, I have brought that up as well. And in fact, there are a number of police departments, whether they're doing it illegally or not, who are avoiding hiring military people as best they can. And there's a second group that I would posit is the reason for these shootings and the pulling of, you know, what I consider oftentimes shooting too quick. But more importantly, because most of those cases, by the way, are justified. I know a lot of people talk a lot of rhetoric, you know, sure, that police are hunting certain right. groups of people. That's not true. Let me tell you, the bar legally is not very high for using deadly force. If truly police were hunting people, the streets would be littered with bodies. It's just not true when you hear that. But getting back to why these things are happening, aside from, and I agree with you, the military aspect, because so many are going into police work when they come home. The other is officers that are not trained well enough. I suspect that's the case with the female officer who shot the gentleman on the highway who was disoriented.
Right.
She shot him so quickly, and I think she was afraid. If you're confident with your weapon, you don't need to unleash hell on somebody and shoot them literally to death.
No, I think that's a really interesting point. David, your thought on that?
Well, you know, I don't know much about police training or whether that's changed over the years. So it's hard for me to comment on the impact that may have had. It just seems to me to be a sort of obvious point, and maybe it's false, but it seems true that if you're coming into a policing situation from experiences in Afghanistan or Syria or
right.
you know, Iraq, that you're just approaching it with a completely different mindset. You know, you're not part of the community there.
Right.
You're there as an occupying force.
Yep.
And it seems to me that a lot of these instances, and I agree with you. I mean, I don't think anyone's, you know, out to kill people indiscriminately. But I think a lot of these instances are examples of sort of people viewing themselves, of police officers viewing themselves as an occupying force, as opposed to a community effort to keep everybody safe.
But I think what's interesting about that too is, and I think we see this in the George Floyd case, I think we see it in some other instances where there were trainees that were literally standing by and learning from the veteran police officers who were doing it wrong. And they weren't doing it by the book, and they had just come out of academy, and here the police officer was giving a version of, well, okay, you know what you've been told, you know, in your classroom, this is how it really works. And I experienced that. I did an investigation into the My Lai massacre back forever ago, and I spoke personally with some young cadets who were going through the same training as Lieutenant Calley had gone through, right? And I spoke to these cadets in confidence, and they said the exact thing, that they learned it the proper way, and then at some point the door gets locked, and whoever was leading the class said, close the books, now let me tell you how it really works. And then it was all about, you do not bring live prisoners back with you, they'll get you killed, better to kill them on the spot. And it was very specific about what they were being told from having been in country. And I think it's that occupying force mentality versus law enforcement and being a member of the community, you know, call a friend, call a cop. But that's why I think the second comment is actually really interesting. It's really informative, because I think that thing about fear, that psychological piece, either comes from feeling like you're an occupying force and at any second you're about to get shot, so you got to keep your head on a swivel all day long, or that when police officers, as he said, it's a very low bar. And so maybe that's the problem, is not enough cops get rooted out who are just fearful by nature. They've become fearful, and a fearful police officer will see malice in every, you know, every finger twitch where there was none actually going on. And then they'll overreact to that. What do you think of that, David?
Well, you know, Ian, one of your advertisers talks about PTSD.
Yeah.
And that one in five people coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq suffer from PTSD. I think it's probably higher than that.
I think I would agree.
I don't know how you serve in those situations and not have PTSD, but whatever the statistics are, that has to play into it. I mean, if you're on the if you've been in, you know, Fallujah, and you know every street corner may have an assassin waiting there, or somebody who's going to blow you up, and then you come to Baltimore, and you're walking around the street, and you know you have a flashback.
Yeah.
You know, it's inconceivable to me that people who have served in those situations, how horrific they are not coming back with PTSD that affects how they react on the street in Baltimore or Birmingham, Alabama, or anywhere else.
Right.
So. Layman's explanation of what's going on.
I think this is really interesting, and I thank you, Tom, for your thoughts. And there's other police officers who want to get on, and I want to talk to them. But I will say then, I will add that the optics for that also come into it. That a lot of cases, some of these neighborhoods where the worst things happen are the neighborhoods that look most like where they may have served in other countries. And the now police officers are armed and they are uniformed in very similar ways to what they would have been wearing had they been in service. So that's something which others have been complaining about for a long time, is that no doubt we had to raise the weapons game in order to keep up with criminals. But it does, it makes, it would be a very familiar, you know, to be dressed the way you're supposed to be, which is SOP in some police departments, I'm certain, is going to feel a lot like how you were dressed when you spent, you know, a couple of years perhaps developing that PTSD to begin with. And so everything about that's going to seem like it's going to bring you back to that other place. Again, layman's opinion, but it's just a thought on that. Well, I want to ask a couple people, everybody who's hanging on, please. We'll get to you. We'll also, we have one or two open lines, and we'll give the numbers here coming up in just a moment. Again, we're talking with David Rudolph, American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. And there are wonderful examples of police officers doing the right thing all the time. Let's just say that declaratively. And nobody is saying that this is true everywhere. But it should never happen. And the kind of abuses that David writes about in the book should never happen. And when they are happened, they should be exposed. And one of those things he talks about is the cover-ups afterward, or the lack of discipline for the people who have done these things. And I'll get to that coming up, too. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. And you've got the phone numbers. You just found those. So make sure you call in and get in this conversation we're having with David Rudolph, American Injustice. Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. One person who's hanging on was a former federal agent. I'm going to talk to him next, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Just like I suspected, it's a full boat of callers. We'll get to you as fast as we can. Let's start with Mark, who's in Port Orchard, Washington, on a wildcard line on Coast to Coast AM for David Rudolph. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, one quick thing. I also have 15 years as a firearms and use of force instructor, in addition to my 30 years of service, primarily federal. And the problem being is a lot has to do with training. Training has changed. When I first went in, you were taught to shoot 2 to 3 shots to be assessed. Now people are being taught you shoot until the threat stops. Well, yeah. How can you tell the threat is stopping if you just dumped 17 rounds into somebody?
Yeah.
Because the body's moving, the guy's flopping around. I mean,
right.
That's reality.
What's the difference between somebody who's recoiling from a bullet and somebody who's trying to reach for a weapon? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where the training comes in. And as far as I'm concerned, I retired in 2008. I tried to do as realistic training as I could. But if you can't do that, you're creating this scenario where, like you said, you get scared. Anybody right. who tells anybody they're not scared is lying to you.
Sure.
Training overcomes the fear. So you don't do this automatic reaction.
Right.
It's but
more about,
the other said,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I'd say a little bit more about muscle memory, but go ahead, you were saying.
Well, that's exactly what it is. You hit it right on the head, it's muscle memory. And I, you know, when I was training all the young new, you know, men and women coming in, man, that's it. Muscle training, muscle memory, over and over and over again, repetition, putting people in situations, firing simunitions and stuff like that. So you get used to, you yell in people's ears, you get them all stressed out. And then, so the training then takes over and they see, oh, well, gee, the training worked. So the next time it actually happens out in the field, they know what to do.
Yeah.
When it, you know, happens for real.
But not so much anymore. So in your 30 years, you had a thought on the conversation we're having with the author of American Injustice, David Rudolph?
Yeah. The other thing, too, is let's face it, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I actually saw, I know of one case in particular, where a U.S. attorney got a problem with a agent and decided that the federal agent was dirty because this federal agent was friends with this inspector that the U.S. attorney had some issues with and decided they were all dirty. So he spent 10 years telling everybody, I'm going to get this agent, I'm going to get this agent, I'm going to get this agent, and basically tried to ruin his career. And there was no basis for it. It was pure personal. You know, and the most ridiculous thing I ever saw, well, it blew up in their face because his agent made this big case with the FBI on this cross-border theft ring. And they're all sitting there going, well, wait a minute. If he's so dirty, how the heck did he do this?
Right.
And then the flip side of that is I was working internal affairs for 3 years, and there was a case where there was an agent that was caught on tape by Texas DPS narcotics, where he was making deals with his informant to smuggle drugs across as a form of payment. So the informant would then tell him what the competition was doing, and then he'd bust the competition and let the informant buy. Well, when it went up to the U.S. attorney, the U.S. in internal affairs, the U.S. attorney asked the Texas officials to step out of the room for a minute. And when they came back in, he said, oh, we're going to handle this. We're going to adopt the case. And the Texas DPS is going, well, wait a minute. You know, that's our narcotics case. And he says, it isn't now. We're doing it federally. You know, don't screw with this. And guess what happened? Nothing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's win-loss ratios. It's politics. You know, it flops all over the place, and that's the sad part. You know, I had a case where I actually had a supervisor try to screw a case up just because the guy got angry at me, you know, which is complete childish.
Right.
But it happens.
Let me ask David for his thoughts on this as you're hearing the story from Mark.
Yeah, and Mark, I appreciate your sharing those stories because people need to hear them. I don't think most people understand that this is the kind of stuff that goes on. But the reality is that the system is operated by people.
Yeah.
And people have in that system have all of the frailties and all of the problems and all of the
ego
defects that everybody in society suffers from. It's
yeah.
just that when they're in those positions of power, the consequences of those defects, of personal animosity, of tunnel vision, of confirmation bias, whatever the problem is, gets exacerbated, and the result can be absolutely devastating. And so, you know, with regard to that agent who was hounded for 10 years, you know, he'll never get that back in terms of his peace of mind and how he was treated during the interim. The fact that he ended up making a great case, that's not going to make up, I don't think, in his mind for the fact that he was treated that way for 10 years. So, you know, it's a question of understanding that the system is populated by people, and what we need are checks and balances to keep people's problems from overwhelming other people.
Yeah, I think that ego piece, too, in there, you know, that idea, it's the several of those stories you mentioned, there was a component of that where somebody talked about, well, it's now my turn, or I'll get this guy. And it just people are playing out their issues with a badge. You know, that's the scary part. It's not like your neighbor and your arguing over, you know, whether his hose is over the property line or something. You got some real authority, some real heft. Kristen is on a first-time caller line in Michigan on Coast to Coast AM for David Rudolph. Kristen? Still there, Kristen? Oh, it says David in Oregon now on first-time. I'm sorry. Go ahead, David.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you very much. Good. For taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do have to say that, yes, there is. I was a police officer for 20 years, and that I was involved in, I was asked to force it to change my testimony while in court on a particular case where I was a cover officer for a neighboring agency in Southern Oregon where I was police officer. And I refused. I said, that's not the way I saw it. That's not, you know, it was a domestic case. And the officer in charge stated that the suspect grabbed a rock and was going to hit him with it. And I said, that's not true. You know, as a cover officer, my job is to make sure that officer stays alive and goes home in an upright position. And I said, as a cover officer, I would never let that happen. And that's not true. The case was actually, we were put on recess, and I was actually taken outside, and I was actually asked to change my testimony. And I said, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not changing my testimony. That's not what happened. And I'm not going to lie for you. You know, and I don't care how many years you have on your agency. This is what I was trained. This is what I was taught. And this is what I'm going to do. And if you don't like it, too bad. You know, I'm not going to send some guy to jail just sure. because you flat don't like him.
So what was the resolution?
The resolution, the case was dismissed.
Yeah. David, and thank you for that, Dave. That kind of speaks to a couple of the stories in your book, too, about how that, you know, the blue wall of silence, we've all heard about that. But even the fact that some cops are caught really pretty obviously having contrived something, planted evidence, falsely testified, and nothing happens to them. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I can talk about that. And maybe the best example is some of these forensic officers who come in and testify about alleged science.
Right.
But, you know, before I do that, let me just comment to Dave that I respect the fact that you wouldn't give in to that.
Yeah.
And it's scary to me that was even asked. I mean, that's
yeah.
the kind of stuff
of course.
That corrupts the system absolutely. You know, there are a lot of people who wouldn't have had the backbone to say, sorry, I'm just not going to do this. So I just wanted to mention that.
I think that's, and I think it really, it's the backbone to think through that ethics and your honor are more important than preserving your retirement fund or getting your wife or husband mad at you because you lost your job. And I think this is where we have lost a little bit, I believe, of that priority, that sense of I'm not going to do that because it's the wrong thing to do. I don't know when it was better, but it sure feels worse now.
No, I agree. So, but let me give you an example of what you were talking about, where folks don't face consequences. So in the staircase, there was a blood spatter expert who came in and testified at great length about how he could determine the exact location where blood started flowing from the angles of origin on the wall. And I knew that it was physically impossible to do that. You can determine an area of origin, but you can't determine a point of origin. But he insisted that he could do that. And it was a big part of the case against my client, and my client was convicted. We flash forward 8 years, and
right.
finally, I was able to establish 8 years later, after my client had served 8 years in prison for something I don't think he ever did, that particular officer, you know, he was a member of the State Bureau of Investigation, had committed perjury. The judge in the case, who was the original trial judge, found that he had committed perjury. It was a finding on the record that he committed perjury. The judge vacated the conviction, and that particular officer was not prosecuted for what the judge himself found to be perjury. That's the kind of stuff that allows, you know, police officers, forensic scientists, or whoever to get on the stand and not do what Dave did, which is refuse to change their testimony, but instead to get on the stand and literally lie in order to help the prosecutor or their buddies make the case. And I don't know of a single solitary expert in that situation who has been prosecuted for perjury. It may have happened, but I'm just not aware of it. It's just inexcusable in my mind.
Yeah, it'll never get better till they do. Deanna is in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Deanna.
Hi. Hi, Ian.
Hi. You're talking to David Rudolph. Go ahead.
Go ahead. An incident happened with my son's dad back in 1987 here in Minnesota. And he was down at the truck stop. He was intoxicated, and someone called the police and said a drunk guy was trying to drive. So three police came down there, and they were going to arrest him. They put him in the back of the car, the squad car. They didn't handcuff him or frisk him before they put him back in the car. And on the way to the station, he pulled out a lighter that looked like a little gun and said he was going to shoot him in the back of the head or something like that. And they stopped the car on this busy street, and they ended up all getting out of the car, two police officers, there's one behind them. And then they let him out of the car, even though he was locked in the back seat. And they ended up shooting him, and he died.
On the side of the road?
And yes, right. Yeah. And there were some people getting off work that worked at some meat packaging plant that there was a bunch of witnesses. That didn't see anything in his hand. And so we tried to sue them, and we lost. We were suing for negligence because someone from the media had sent in a policy from their police department saying all people that are getting arrested, you have to handcuff and frisk them before you put them in the back of your car. And they didn't do that. And we still lost.
I'm so
We were suing for the kids.
Oh, I don't blame you. And that's a whole other side of this, which we really haven't talked much about, the civil side, the restitution of it all, if it's even possible. But, David, there's Deanna.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to hear that story, Deanna. But, you know, part of the problem is that police officers have what's called a good faith immunity, qualified immunity. And so the fact that they acted negligently is not enough to hold a police officer liable. You have to prove that the police officer either acted intentionally or so recklessly as to ignore the serious risk of danger to life or limb. So that's a whole nother issue. Qualified immunity is something that was created by the Supreme Court. It's not in the statute. It wasn't created by any legislature. There are a lot of people who feel like qualified immunity is part of the problem because, if you or I are out in the street and we're driving a car, and we act negligently and kill somebody, we don't have any immunity for that. You know, if we're negligent, we're negligent. And I'm not sure why, police officers would need anything more than what everybody else has, which is you just don't act negligently and you're not liable. So that's part of the problem. Of course, prosecutors have absolute immunity. They can't be sued even if they intentionally do something
that's
illegal.
That's crazy.
And so immunity is something that needs to be looked at.
That just seems crazy. They could intentionally do it and still not be held responsible under some clause like that. What's the incentive in doing it right then? What's the market force? It's just their own individual integrity, but God help us, we've seen where that can often go. All right, so if you are enjoying this conversation and you have something you want to add, we'll try and get a line for you coming up. David, how are you feeling about this last hour? Are you going to make it?
Good. I'm all good.
Okay. You see how much we literally have, like, everybody lined out the door to talk to you. If this were a book signing, you'd be making bank.
Well, unfortunately, it's not, but that's okay. I hope that people will actually go out and buy the book or borrow it if they can't afford to buy it and read it, because I think the stories are interesting and really informative.
Good. No, I do. I hope I'm saying the title enough so that they can't forget it. But remember, they can link up to it and go right now to coasttocoastam.com and find American Injustice: Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. David Rudolph, who is the defense attorney featured in Netflix's The Staircase, and the host of the podcast Abuse of Power, returns then for our last hour and taking your calls on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.